Hi, this is Shane Vanderhurt. I'm interviewing Representative Chris Rantz, who was the former Iowa Speaker of the House and currently representing House District 54, which encompasses Sioux City and Sergeant Bluffs, and he is a current gubernatorial candidate. And Chris, I just want to thank you for taking time to meet with me today.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, well, tell me a little bit about yourself outside the political realm.
Okay. Let's see. What to know about me? Married. Two kids. I met my wife, Trudy, while we were in college. She was dating the guy who lived down the hall from me. She set me up with her best friend. Either that worked out for either of us, and we started hanging out together. Got married in 1992. I came back from our honeymoon and found out that my state representative, Don Schoening, was announcing he was not going to run for re-election. We got married in 92, which was the same year I got elected. I told her, you know, hey, babe, we knew this was going to happen again. I just didn't know it was that I was going to run. I just didn't know it was going to be now. I've got two girls. My eldest, Grace, is in high school, freshman. My youngest, Kate, is in middle school, sixth grader, which unique challenges that go with all that. Used to work for a company called Mintz Baking Company, you know, old homebred. Did environmental compliance work. I kind of fell into that job. I went to work for our corporate attorney. I'm not an attorney, but I was doing real estate work. We had, you know, we were in 18 different states. We had hundreds of route agencies and thrift stores and keeping track of all the property and buying new ones and the leases and stuff like that. They needed somebody to do full time. So I was doing that, and I sort of uncovered this conspiracy of silence between the VP of engineering and the VP of transportation to not deal with things like leaky underground storage tanks and oil spills and things like that, because they're both a couple years away from retirement. Nobody ever really wants to go in and tell Bill Mintz, hey, we have to spend money and there's no return on the investment. And I put together a plan and sent it to him through my boss. And lo and behold, I got to be responsible for underground storage tanks. And the two guys I thought who would want to kill me ended up saying, thank you for dealing with this. And that led to clean water and clean air and everything else like that. I got into it about the same time that the US EPA had started deciding they had to regulate air emissions on food processors. And bakeries in particular have a lot of air emissions. And, you know, got to spend a lot of time in California dealing with their environmental compliance or environmental protection agency, our version of the DNR in Wisconsin and Chicago. And we had, you know, bakeries emit ethanol. At the time, the US EPA believed that what we were emitting was a source of greenhouse gases. That's how they categorized it. And we're either going to shut us down or force us to spend literally millions of dollars on catalytic oxidizers or other mechanisms to burn off the ethanol emissions, burn off the smell of baking bread, basically. Mm-hmm. Everybody does it. Grandma, grandpa do it. And their grandmas do it in their ovens when they bake bread. We just do it thousands of loaves every hour. And, you know, it was an interesting experience. It was a unique experience. I tried to apply some of that to what I, you know, what I learned there to when I came in the General Assembly. I got elected in 92. I was the surprise winner. Nobody expected me to win my primary. Okay. I won that by 17 votes. Close election, 17 votes, landslide. And nobody expected me to win my general election. You know, I got a whopping $500 check from the Republican Party of Iowa, a nice pat on the back, and said, go get them, good luck. And that was kind of it. And then when I won, it was, oh, whoa, where did that happen? How did that happen?
Were you facing an incumbent?
No, it was an open seat. Okay. But Don Keeler, who was the Democrat at the time, former news anchor in Sioux City, one of my college professors, you know, he's big out in the Air Guard. He was, you know, he had the list. If you wanted to put together a great-looking candidate, that was Don.
Sure.
Except I won the election on a TV ad. I mean, I worked my tail off, right? Door to door, all summer long, I mean, all fall long. But the turning point was, because I was down in the polls, the turning point was he had said, he kept coming out with all these proposals during the course of the campaign to spend money on this and spend money on that and spend money on anything, and he was well-financed. I mean, he was really well-financed. Democrats were the majority party at that time. And I finally got him in a TV debate, and I looked at him and I said, Don, you know, I've added up all these programs that you've proposed, and it's $500 million worth of new spending. So my other question is, whose taxes would you raise to pay for it, and, you know, which tax would it be? And Don looks back at me, you know, across the camera, and he says, well, Christopher, I didn't say half the things you've said I've said, blah, blah, blah. But to answer your question, what I would propose, and I do say propose, is a 10% surcharge on blah, 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 blah. And it was basically another sales tax is what it worked out to.
Okay.
I thought, oh, that's interesting. So that was sort of the end of it. We go through the rest of the League of Women Voters debate, and I go back home because it's televised. I pull the cassette out of the VCR. Uh-huh. I go back down to the television studio, and we cut a commercial. Don on tape saying what he would, you know, he was going to basically raise taxes. Uh-huh. And the polling numbers, reverse course. We aired that commercial after the East Healing game on Friday night at 10 o'clock. And, you know, that's the first time it aired. And mm-hmm. It ran all weekend, but he couldn't change. You know, he couldn't put up a TV ad or change anything like that. And Monday morning we had another radio exchange on open line radio debate, and it was down at Timothy's restaurant, and I thought he was going to come across the table at me. I mean, the announcer, Randy Renshaw, basically had to like get between us because Don was ready to come kill me. And I just said on the radio, I said, look, if anybody thinks I took his remarks out of context, A, it'll be aired again on cable access on Tuesday and Thursday this week, and or call me at home, my number's in the book, I'll bring the videotape over and let you watch the whole debate. End of the campaign. It's, you know. So.
Great.
I've been raining a little bit here. I know that probably wasn't what you wanted.
Oh, no, that's... Why'd you decide to run for governor?
It's a long, complicated answer. And there's no one single reason.
Sure.
If you would have asked me back in November, December, January, February, I would have said, yeah, I don't think so. I mean... If you would have asked me 3 years ago, I would have told you I wanted to run. Anytime you sit in the speaker's chair, your negotiations across the table from the governor, mm-hmm. you realize, well, they didn't take a particular smart pill, you know, one day and get that job. Especially with Phil Psaki, he's no different than me. Kind of a wonky kind of a guy, came out of the state senate. I always figured I could do that job. But after the setbacks in the 08 election, I was really soured. I mean, I was ready to quit. Okay. Get out. I mean, run my course. I've done what I could do. Just not my time. Didn't work out. Kind of down on politics. But a lot of things transpired. One, I saw the... Bob's running again, okay? Mm-hmm. Third time. And I remember listening to his interview on the day he said he's making his announcement that he was mm-hmm. exploring running, mm-hmm. right? And I'm listening to that interview as I'm driving to Des Moines, listening to Michelson, and he says at the top of the hour, you know, I told Bobby Jindal I'd love to be governor when, you know, there's a $600 million budget deficit so I could get in there and cut spending. And I listened for the next 3 hours, and I never heard one example of anything he was going to cut.
Okay.
Come on, Bob. I've not been a big Bob fan, and you probably know that already. I see lots of holes in his resume.
Okay.
But my problem as either a candidate or as a just a constituent looks at presidential candidates or other candidates that are running for election, I'm looking for real specific things. I'm looking for real answers, not maybe it's because I've just been around it too much. The soundbite, the glib answer, the one-liner, I'm sorry, it may play great on the evening news, but that's not really what solves problems. And I'm about solving problems. I realize Bob's not the guy. But, okay, that's somebody else's problem to deal with. Keep thinking somebody's going to step forward. Maybe Northey's going to step forward. Maybe Vought's going to step forward. Maybe King will get in. Surely somebody's going to get in. And then we have what I call the confluence of events.
Mm-hmm.
That I go to Israel and Egypt this year. And that was a... It was a very moving experience for me. It rekindled the fire mm-hmm. within. I'm part of this group, this Aspen Rodel Fellowship I got nominated for. And our first meeting was actually in January out in Aspen. And no taxpayer dollars involved, by the way. The Rodel family financed it. But, you know, I'm there with the new
Republican leader for the Nevada legislature. I'm there with the new Republican leader from the Hawaii legislature. I'm there with the guy who just got elected attorney general in Kentucky, the guy who's the new blah, blah, blah. They're all up-and-comers, right? They're all climbing the ladder. They're new leaders. And I joked around because I was the last guy. Everybody on the first night goes around and introduces themselves. And I got up, and I'm the last guy here. You know, I don't know why I'm here. I'm the only guy who's not climbed the ladder. I'm the guy who's on the downhill slide. That's how I felt at the time. You know, sure. Politics, I'm done. But it's those kinds of things because our reading assignments are Thoreau and Locke, and we're reading from the Federalist Papers and King's letter from a Birmingham City jail. And I mean, it's a heavy duty weekend, but that's the stuff I love, you know, and I like just that the dialogue and the argument that goes along with it. But so this group then takes two overseas trips, and one was to Egypt and Israel, which just was an amazing. It's a trip of a lifetime and a life-changing trip. Just the exposure to another culture, but also I made it my own sort of little religious pilgrimage. I mean, sure. When our meetings are done for the day, most people would go back to the hotel room and crash, right? Because we've been traveling so much, we're on a tight schedule. And there were a handful of us that would say, no, we're going to stick it out a little longer. We'll go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at midnight. That's a powerful place to visit anyway. But you go there at night, and, I mean, you're literally the last group through before the priests close it down. You visit the tomb that Christ was buried in. Mm-hmm. You climb the hill to Golgotha. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, if you're a believer, it's, you walk away with either tears in your eyes or your tingle going up and down your spine. But I took full advantage of that. And so a combination of that and what was going on in my own heart, because I'm trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, and being around these other up-and-coming politicians, I came home on fire. I don't know what I'm on fire for, but I'm on fire to do something. And that's kind of the time that I reengaged in the legislative debate. I mean, I'd been sitting in the back row, keeping to myself and not engaging.
You pretty much pulled out of leadership altogether.
Well, I got shoved out of leadership. Yeah, let's be honest about it. I got shoved out of leadership, and I understood that. I didn't like it, but people were looking to show that we've changed, okay? I don't know what that means, but I don't believe in changes for the sake of change. But, I understand that. I'd done it. I get it. No hard feelings. But I'd sort of sit in the back. But that was the time when I came home and I started reengaging, helping a racker with the budget. Getting up on the floor and re-engaging when they needed me to re-engage. But when I come home, the marriage decision comes down. I mean, we have the rallies going on outside. We've got the Tea Party stuff that's starting to happen. You see people getting engaged again where I thought people of our mindset had given up or were lost. And then I get Culver on Monday saying, you know, he's going to punt on the marriage issue. And on Thursday, he's backing up on his no tax increase pledge by grabbing hold of federal deductibility. And I thought, man, he's done what no Republican can do. I mean, he's probably united the Republican Party, both halves of the Republican Party coming together. So there's some hope here. And I started having people ask me questions. You know, I'm at my Chamber of Commerce meeting, and 7:30 meeting on a Friday morning. And they said, well, who's going to run? You know, if you're telling us that there's hope here, I'm suddenly feeling that there's hope and seeing potential possibility. Well, who's going to be our nominee? Well, there'll be somebody. I mean, surely we can do better than Bob. There's a lot of Republicans who believe Bob is a well-intentioned individual, but it's all about just winning the nomination and not really about governing. And where are the ideas? What is it you'd really do? And I kept struggling for them. People said, well, why don't you run? Well, I ran out of reasons not to. I mean, my mindset had changed about the fact that I think there is a potential for us to win. I think we've been given opportunities. I kept seeing things getting worse. And I didn't see anybody stepping forward and offering real alternatives. The problem Republicans face against Chet Culver is Chet Culver is a likable guy. Mm-hmm. Okay, he is the big lug. I mean, he's taken that and he's owned that, and that's why I was elected him. He's a likable guy. He's the guy you want to go sit down and have a beer with, you know, on a Saturday afternoon and watch a football game. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to say that about me. I know that. I'm a little too...
Oh, you seem like warm fuzzy.
Bristly occasion. I'm the guy who you want to have come in and do your taxes. I'm the guy who's going to come in and fix your leaky sink. I'm the guy who's going to come and get your kids ready for school. But the fact is, I think come 2010, Iowans need somebody to fix the leaky sink, get their taxes done, get their kids ready for school. Because
they're looking for confidence.
The guy who's having a beer out in the garage isn't getting that job done. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm just naive or optimistic enough to believe that competence still matters. Competence still counts and will count in 2010. And so I had the campaign trail. And I just went out and started talking to people. And... you know, got positive response. People were looking for answers. I have more people tell me, well, you're the only guy who's really talking about issues. Yeah. I mean, being specific. And so I don't know if that answered your question or not, but that's sort of my life. That's sort of my life.
I can kind of check off my
going through that
too.
Experience.
Because my next question was, why should Iowans Republicans choose you over the other five candidates? I think you...
Oh. And it's more than that. I mean, look, we all, I had a friend say, you know, he watched us at the Sioux City debate, right? And there were just four of us there at the mm-hmm. time. I mean, he said, you know, I'm looking up there and it's Coke, Pepsi, Shasta, and, you know, RC. Mm-hmm. You know, you're all pro-life, right? You all want to do something about marriage. You're all for smaller government. You know. The way I think I distinguish myself from my fellow Republicans is we fundamentally believe a lot of the same things in the big picture. But... there's only one of us that keeps laying out concrete ideas. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, I said, Bob said he'd cut, you know, he'd love to cut the budget. I've yet to hear an example of what he'd cut. Maybe I've missed it. I've laid out $500 million worth of cuts. And some of it, you know, will be popular and some of it won't. I recognize that. But I think you got to tell Iowans what you'd actually cut. Mm-hmm. I've actually laid out what I do on property taxes. That will be unpopular in some quarters. Mm-hmm. But I think that's what we got to do. I'm a little different than some of the other guys, other than now Terry, in that I've actually run against Democrats, okay? I've run winning campaigns. You know, I know there are some people that want to saddle me with the fact that other Republican candidates lost, okay? I realize mm-hmm. I have to deal with that. But you know what? If I tell a candidate to get out and knock on doors and they don't, I don't know why I should have to bear the burden for that, okay? If I go out and tell a candidate, you need to have a fundraiser, you need to raise money, and they won't. I don't know why I should have to bear the burden for that. But, you know, it goes with it, so I carry it. But, you know, I run against Democrats. They don't give me a bye. They try to pin me down and punish me. I realize I'm the guy that a lot of Democrats love to hate, mm-hmm. At least in the capital and the political circles.
Which is a conservative, that's actually a badge of honor.
Well, yeah, it's never really bothered me before. I have to be careful about that now, though, you know, mm-hmm. if you're in this kind of a situation. But I'm a little different in that respect. I mean, Bob's never run against a Democrat, and he thinks that's a badge of honor. I think that Iowans want to see some background, want to mm-hmm. see some proof of your decision-making, and I've got the record on that. Rod, love Rod, he's beaten one Democrat, and... even though he's been there for a long time, they don't run against him. And it's because he does a good job in his district. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that that's the kind of electoral record mm-hmm. that we want to have. Now, Terry obviously is different. Terry's won, you know, elections, obviously. But in that regard, Terry and I are the only ones who have that in common.
Okay.
So that's a little different. You know, again, I think I've got a mixed experience, both from the business community and the putting that to work in the public sector. So I think that I'm a balanced candidate from that regard. And I'm a balanced candidate. Again, I got into this because to a certain extent I see this thing going in our party where you've got two parts that are trying to shove the other side out of the tent. Mm-hmm. Or the minority party, okay? Even if mm-hmm. we keep everybody inside the tent.
We still got a big challenge.
We still have a big challenge. We can't afford to shove anybody out. And I realize I may not be people's first pick. Right? But I believe that because I have appeal, I have a solid record with both parts of the party. If you're a budget, tax, you know, fiscal hawk, mm-hmm. okay, you should look at my record. You should be pleased with that. If you're a social conservative whose number one issue is abortion or marriage or something like that, you're pleased with my record. I mean, maybe Bob's your first choice because he talks about his executive order. Okay. You know what? If Bob's not the guy, and I am, you should be equally pleased with me because I've got 100% pro-life voting record. I'm the guy who pushed that legislation with his majority leader speaker. I'm the only guy who's actually done something on the marriage issue. That's the only thing that'll set me apart from people.
Yeah, and I'll let you get to specifics in a little bit.
Sure.
with those areas. Kind of moving on, just briefly.
Well, this is digital, right? We've got gigabytes we can chew up.
That's true. We do, yes. Yeah. If you were to win a nomination and you were to win a general election, what on day one, what would be your top three priorities?
Day one, first thing, and this is, may not be what you want to hear, but day one, okay, fire the negotiating team.
Okay.
Okay? Simply because you have to deal with that budget right out of the gate. Okay, you have no time to waste because the legislature is already in session and you have to be in collective bargaining with the state employees. You fire the negotiating team and you take it over yourself.
Okay.
Okay. Two, every you pick up the phone, you call the director of the Department of Economic Development and you say, you know what, right to work goes back on every scrap of paper that we have.
Okay.
Okay, because we're going to go out and aggressively market Iowa as a right to work state. Three, you pick up the phone, you tell your new, I guess it's probably still Judy Jeffries until you replace her, your Department of Education person, we're going to raise standards, and we're going to do it executively to the extent that we can. And then you go have breakfast, okay, because you can do all that on your own from the get-go. Then you submit to the General Assembly a budget that reduces spending. You've heard me say repeatedly, I think property taxes are our biggest issue. And so you're going to end up hopping in the car on day one and day two and day three and start going around to Iowans and start building the case for the changes that we need to make to deal with property taxes. Because part of the problem with any time the last few governors have tried to deal with property taxes, they've tried to do it all from Terrace Hill or inside the Capitol building. I told Vilsack in his last term, I said, you're missing your opportunity. You've got political capital built up that you can spend now, but you can't spend it in the Capitol. You have to go out and you have to talk to Iowans about the changes we need to make and what happens if we don't make the changes and what happens if we do. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do that. He tried to do it all inside the Capitol. Governor's going to have to get out and hit the road and talk to Iowans about that because I'm convinced that we are in a death spiral. So that's probably day one. But the new governor starts out with the General Assembly that's already in session and a billion-dollar budget problem. I mean, Culver won't fix it all this year. And it's going to be awful. I mean, it will be awful. I remember when I came in 92. I mean, we had a $450 million budget deficit in 1992 when I got elected. In January 93, from the very first week, we had to start making budget cuts. And it was miserable. I don't look forward to doing that again, but it's what we got to start doing again. And that sort of becomes your first priority because there are some things you can put off for a little bit during the course of a 100-day legislative session and some things that you're already right in the middle of.
Sure.
And look, part of the thing, and I've said this about, you want to talk about marriage now?
Or
do you want to wait?
Because
that's part of the notice that you give to the General Assembly. But we'll save that till we get to that question.
Okay, sounds good.
Good luck transcribing this.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Let's see, Governor Culver's 10% across the board cut to the state budget. You've called
dumb and lazy. It is dumb and lazy.
It is. I agree with you. How would you approach spending cuts and shrink the size of government? I've heard some of your ideas.
Sure. Well, first of all, you have to prioritize. And that's why an across-the-board cut is dumb and lazy. Look, there's some things we're going to have to do differently. And there's some things we're going to have to get away from altogether. I use the preschool example a lot because to me it makes absolutely no sense. It was something I was opposed to from the very beginning. You're spending $53 million to provide 10 hours of instruction per week to only 16,000 kids. Okay. Hey, we shouldn't be trying to take preschool away from churches and nonprofits. Bad deal. Can't afford it. School districts will even admit that now, especially in light of what's going on. You got to get rid of that. Look, we're going to have to take some risks, okay? I said the other night, you know, we're going to have to get rid of the Department of Human Rights. For the amount of money we're spending, we don't need it, okay? I mean, it's nice. Ideally, all of the things in state government are nice. If you had an unlimited amount of money and everything was just fine. But we don't. And we can't afford it. And so a whole lot of things are going to have to go. State employees, we're going to have to reduce the size, and they're going to have to take cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's going to be a big problem. we're going to have to look at what state government should be involved in and what it shouldn't. The state of Iowa has no business operating a telephone company. People tend to forget that, okay? But, hey, we force local school districts to use it. We force colleges to use it. We got to get out of the business of the IC, and we got to sell that sucker. We ought to take the money that we get from it and plow that back into the state budget. That's probably a one-time savings.
Think you'd have any takers to buy ICN?
Yeah, I actually do. Okay. And here's why somebody will come along and buy it. Because as long as the ICN is out there, that discourages private investment. Okay. Because the state of Iowa takes and creams the marketplace. Right? We get all the state government as a customer, state agencies as a customer, local governments as a customer, community colleges as a customer. And they're always afraid of what people like Doris Kelly and others are going to want to do. Representative Doris Kelly, who wants to expand the ICN to serve more purposes. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's have a state Wi-Fi system, you know, and the ICN will be the backbone for it. Mm-hmm. Well, as long as people keep saying things like that, there's no way that INS or Verizon or anybody else is going to come along and make that kind of investment in the state. Mm-hmm. When you're competing against a nonprofit who owns the backbone, nobody's going to invest. And that's part of our problem in this state.
Okay.
And that's why we lag behind in some rural areas. So we've got to get out of that business. We should have been out of that business for years, but now's a perfect time to do the fire sale. And it will be a fire sale, okay? We'll never get the amount of money out of it that Branstad put into it. Mm-hmm. But we can get some money now, use that to help cushion some of our budget problems. We got to look at the 23 different state agencies that are providing early childhood services. We've got to consolidate that. Mm-hmm. We absolutely have to consolidate that. We've got to look at what kind of services we're providing for with Medicaid dollars. I mean, we don't have some people think we have a Cadillac plan. I wouldn't tell you that we have a Cadillac plan, but we have a really good Chevy. Mm-hmm. It's going to be unpopular, but we're going to have to look at some of those kinds of things. We're going to have to back off on how many kids we've got in the Hawkeye program, or how many kids we're trying to push into the Hawkeye program. You go through the laundry list. There's a ton of stuff. We've got to look at, you know, the regions are going to take a hit this year, well, but it's what we're spending on the regions.
Back to Hawkeye, I'm just wondering, how much expansion was caused by SCHIP and sustainability in the long term?
Well, some of it is, but some of it also the last 2 years, Hatch and company have tried to put more kids into the system.
Okay.
All done at the state level. And, of course, now we'll see what happens with the federal bill. That will have profound impact on the state budget. If it goes through as it is right now, you're looking at 300,000 more Iowans that are eligible for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Well, we can't afford that.
Well, I'm just wondering, the Senate version, they're talking about having state opt-out option. And that actually could be played in the Republicans' favor as a state issue.
Yes, but here's the problem with that. Okay, and that's why we shouldn't count on that here's how we're going to survive.
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath.
Because other states will not opt out. Okay, and as other states fall into the federal system, that's going to kill your insurance industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is designed to kill the insurance industry. And pretty soon, when you have particularly multi-state corporations that decide, why should I pay for health care if they can pick it up? And so they make those changes, and it will impact their Iowa subsidiaries or their Iowa, you know, stores or manufacturing plants or whatever. Eventually, we'll see a collapse of the insurance industry as we know it. And that'll impact Iowa in a negative way. Mm-hmm. The dominoes fall. It's just a question of when. Now, we can say we'll hold out as long as we can, but the fact is the system is geared against us. It's a very perverse way to say, oh, you have an option. Really?
Yeah.
My option is for what? Because there's nothing left.
I wish they had an opt-in.
Exactly. That'll be a different deal. That'll be a different deal.
Okay. What would you do to, you know, help create private sector jobs? It seems like we've had a lot of job. Well, the iJobs money has been basically filtered to every single county.
You know my deal on that. You've heard that speech.
Sure.
Look, it's property taxes, okay? With all due respect to Ryden Christian, they've got good ideas, but that's not what's going to solve our problem, okay? Because it's our property tax system. That's what's pushing people over. We were doing okay in Sioux City. Even though we were next to South Dakota and they're at zero, they were creaming us on some things. But it's when our property taxes suddenly got worse than South Dakota's, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. Because it doesn't matter how much money you're making. It doesn't matter if you're profitable or not. You're going to pay that.
Yeah.
And if you are an out-of-state, we need to be focused on how we grow our own jobs. Okay. But if you're an out-of-state company, and you're looking at putting a manufacturing plant in or a subsidiary or even a store, whatever it is, okay, you look at Iowa. You're not planning on moving your management team to Iowa. We'd like that, but let's say you're not. Mm-hmm. Income taxes don't matter at that stage of the game. It's how profitable is that plant going to be? So you take what they're going to make and you subtract their cost of the inputs, and property taxes is one of those costs, and bang, we're suddenly uncompetitive there. You got to do something about that first. Because they probably want their employees to do well, but what their employees pay in income taxes isn't as big of a deal to that person mm-hmm. as what they're going to end up paying in property taxes, whether that plant makes a profit or not. We cannot be the third highest in the nation for property taxes and think that we're going to succeed.
Very true.
So that's where we have to tackle. And that means grabbing hold of that third rail, like I talked about, mm-hmm. with local governments and talking to them about streamlining. We are in a situation where it is unsustainable. It is unsustainable. And I defy anybody to tell me how 10 years from now you have 362 school districts and they're all successful. How we support the level of local governments that we have. We have 990 local governments, not counting school districts. Mm-hmm. How we're going to continue to support all those? We can't. We can't do it. We all want our local services, but we can't support it with the property taxes. It's only going to get piled on heavier and heavier and heavier.
I mean, yeah, everybody gets parochial when it comes to that. I mean, with the whole Des Moines Polk County merger, they pretty much went down in flames. I mean, nobody wants to.
But here's the thing: they don't see any savings to it. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean that's part of the problem.
Yeah, it wasn't a very good plan,
and that's why you need to have something out there where the state says, you know what, if you'll experiment, we'll pick up the administrative cost so you can see some savings. Mm-hmm. Okay? Here's my example. Woodbury County eliminates our county recorder, right? Mm-hmm. And what happened since that time? Oh, we survive. We do just fine without a county recorder. And every year the county recorders come back to the General Assembly and say, we need more duties in the code. God forbid we eliminate the county recorder. Mm-hmm. I mean, life as we know it in the counties will fall apart. That's insane.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is it in any county we need to have multiple chiefs of police? We all want to have the patrol person. We want to know when we dial 911 that the car rolls up with the cherries flashing at 2 o'clock in the morning. But how many administrators do we need to make sure that happens? We don't. But the system is geared against making those savings because it's all decided by the local elected officials who A, may lose their jobs, or B, by the administrators who will lose their jobs. You have to empower the citizens, the taxpayers, to put it forward. And the state has to be a partner by putting some money up front to say, we'll pick up some of those administrative costs. Mm-hmm. And you know what? If say in Woodbury County, we get down to one chief of police, call it the county sheriff. You know, I don't care mm-hmm. what you call it. But we save some money, and it works for us, and we demonstrate that we don't need two law enforcement centers across the street from each other, mm-hmm. and that we can save some money. Then maybe some other county chooses to follow suit. Yeah. And if it's a complete and utter failure and the criminals run rampant, okay, then no other county will follow suit and we only had one problem there.
Sure.
But see, we're going to have to experiment. We're going to have to show Iowans that it can be done. And it's going to take, that's where it takes some leadership and the governor spending some political capital. And that's why I freely talk about it. And some people say, oh, you can't talk about, you know, consolidating governments or merging services. I mean, people won't like that. Well, then turn out the lights when you leave because we'll be out of there. But I'm talking about it because I want to have that mandate. This is the problem with too many candidates. They say, vote for me, but they won't tell you what they're going to do until after they get elected. Mm-hmm. Well, then you have no mandate for that. You didn't campaign on that. Mm-hmm. See, Barack Obama actually has a mandate for some of the stuff he's doing.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, people who were surprised weren't paying any attention during the election cycle. But I want to know when I get elected, you know, that I can go out and say, these are the things I ran on. I was real specific with you why this program's going away or that program's going away. And when I get elected, and I will have said publicly, I'll hold Mike Ronsall and Pat Murphy accountable and say they won't be able to adjourn until they pass that, you know, they have a vote on the H.R. 60 or whatever it's going to be on a constitutional amendment to define marriage. I will have said that publicly, guys. So when it's April 30th and you're still mm-hmm. sitting around the Capitol, I told you this day was coming.
Yeah.
Same thing if it's true on property taxes. I grabbed the third rail. Iowans voted for me. We're going to make some changes.
Great. Moving on to segue.
Into marriage.
Marriage. Yeah, you know, one of the priorities for social conservatives is to see that April 3rd Iowa Supreme Court decision ruling address what is your position, and what tangible things would you do as governor?
Well, let's start by having the conversation about why did the Supreme Court rule the way that it did? Mm-hmm. Why did it?
Well,
I'll give you two reasons why they did. Yeah. One, in the 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s, when the Department of Human Services decided that gay couples were a suitable place mm-hmm. to put children for adoption and put children for foster care, at that point in time, the state of Iowa said, that's a family unit. It's an acceptable family unit, and it's a better family unit than this other one. Mm-hmm. So when the state of Iowa already says that, game is over.
Yeah, well, okay? they start becoming it's a legitimate thing then.
That's right. The state has put their stamp of approval on that as a family unit. That's right. The family unit is there to raise kids and ensure a safe and a good environment to raise kids. That's why we have families. Mm-hmm. And when the state says that's an acceptable family unit, the game was lost. Okay, it was just a matter of time for everything else to catch up to it. But that's when it was lost. Two, when Chet Culver signed the Civil Rights Bill, mm-hmm. and all those Democrats voted for it, and a handful of Republicans voted for it,
yes,
that sealed the deal. That was the nail in the coffin, okay, because that said you can't discriminate. A lot of people tend to, they get all upset at the court, okay, and I'm equally upset at the court, but if you take a step back, and you look at what led to this decision. Mm-hmm. This is just the cherry on top. This is not the beginning and the end. This is just the end of a series of things that have happened in this state. And the problem is, those people who did those things were never held accountable for it. You know, people who get upset at the representative now for not voting for the marriage amendment, were they upset 2 years ago or at the last election yeah. when they voted for the Civil Rights Bill and said you can't?
No, I was, but...
And people should have been. So where was the outrage then? Where was the outrage when the Department of Human Services says that, you know, we're going to put kids with these couples? Okay, so as upset as I am at the court, I don't say, you'll never hear me say that the court acted unconstitutionally, because I don't think they did. I disagree with them, but you read the Varnum decision, mm-hmm. I understand why they made that ruling. I disagree with the ruling, but I understand why they made that ruling.
Okay.
Now, there's a fix to it. See, when Bob says they drove without a license and all the rest of the stuff, I know that people want to hear that. There are a lot of people who are very fearful of runaway courts. Mm-hmm. But you got to look at why the court ruled the way that it did. And a lot of people don't want to accept our share of the responsibility in allowing that to happen when we allow these other things to happen unchecked.
Okay.
Okay? So, I believe there are some people who disagree with this. The court can nullify bills that are unconstitutional. They decided this is unconstitutional.
Sure, well, that is proper function of the court to interpret.
I believe that constitutionality. There are some people that don't. Mm-hmm. I don't think Bob does.
Okay.
Okay, having talked to some of the same constitutional scholars that he's talked to, there are some people who believe, you know, the courts can't and shouldn't do that. I mean, I've had a guy, I was in Pella, was yelling at me. I said, you know, I'm not going to yell back because that doesn't solve anything. But courts can't decide what's constitutional or not. That's still the law. No, it's not.
But
no, it's not.
You read the Constitution. That's their primary job.
Yes.
What I had thought they should have done, instead of saying, well, this is going to start immediately, instead what they should have done is what Massachusetts did and refer it back to the legislature for a vote.
That would have been something they could have done. Absolutely. And the legislature had a duty to review it, okay? When the Supreme Court two years ago, struck down our flag desecration law, we didn't just say, oh, there's nothing we can do. Mm-hmm. No, the legislature looked at what the court said, why the court ruled the way that it did, and responded, fixed the law. We did it statutorily. We were able to fix what we had statutorily mm-hmm. without a constitutional amendment. I believe this could be fixed statutorily. Not everybody agrees with me, but I think it would be worth a shot. But failing that, you put in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And you make the case, and you just tell Iowans, this is what it's going to be, is I won't let the legislature adjourn. It's that simple. And you will eventually have that stare down. But here's the thing. There are a lot of Democrats. This is what we don't like to talk about. There are a lot of Democrats that were told by Pat Murphy, Speaker Murphy, they'd mm-hmm. never have to vote on this. Mm-hmm. I made them vote on it. They're more pissed off at Pat Murphy than they are at me mm-hmm. about that. Okay? There are a lot that want to get on the right side of that issue. And so, I haven't given up on the fact that we can try this again this year. Gronstall's the problem. We all know that. Mm-hmm. Gronstall's the problem in the Senate. So you have to build a pressure on his members, and you have to keep his members there. And the governor can force that vote. The governor can force that vote. The executive order is a nice soundbite. People want to believe that, you know, there's a silver bullet. There is no silver bullet. All the executive order does is create a circular argument. I mean, you're going to go right back to the courts. There's no county attorney that's going to enforce it. And as long as there's one county attorney or one county recorder that decides they're not, that they're going to keep issuing licenses, then it doesn't work anyway. And that'll happen in Johnson County.
It weakens your position, too.
Exactly. I mean, let's think about this. If the governor can choose what Supreme Court orders he's going to enforce or not, you know, you've elected a dictator. I mean, I sued Tom Vilsack. The Supreme Court agreed with me. Vilsack didn't issue an executive order, couldn't issue an executive order to just ignore the court order that said the governor was wrong. You really do create a constitutional crisis at that point. And some people want to do that. There are some people that want to do it. There's an easier, better solution than that. And again, I go back to this. I haven't talked about it. I've done it. I mean, I voted for DOMA. We saw this day coming. I mean, my county is one of the ones where one of those court cases were filed. That's why we passed the constitutional amendment through the House when I was Speaker of the House. Now, unfortunately, the Senate couldn't get the job done. We know why. But we saw this day coming. And again, I didn't stand outside on the steps of the Capitol and make speeches to get applause. My colleagues came to me and said, Chris, we need your help. We need you to find a way to get a vote on this thing. And I did. So I won't take a backseat to anybody on this.
Okay. How would you, as governor, advance the pro-life agenda? Maybe highlight some of the things you've done as a legislator first.
I will be honest. In the legislature, I was usually just the guy who they'd come to. Here's the language we'd like to move. I'd figure out how to get it moved for them. I mean, I was more of a mechanic than that. I had guys like Dan Boddicker in my caucus, who's my, you know, human services guy, who take that and run with it. Look, if we're going to do something about the number of abortions in this country, it's about changing hearts and minds, right?
Absolutely.
Some people don't want to admit that because that's tough, right? They're looking for the silver bullet. We just pass this bill and it'll solve all our problems. It won't, okay? I'm one who tends to believe the more knowledge and the more information we give people, that's what will do it. Whether it be information you provide to mothers, you know, the young women pregnant, if you actually show them what's going to happen, if you let them know, and you let them know that there are alternatives, you got to win them over one at a time. And part of that can be done legislatively. Woman's right to know. I mean, I passed that 3 times, I think, twice. Every time we did it, Vilsack came up with a reason to veto it. But it's those kinds of things. I tell you what, and when you have a budget crisis like this, now's the time to eliminate the family planning money. Okay, it all goes to Planned Parenthood. It's a small amount of money. Okay, it's not going to solve our budget problem, but this is your excuse to get it out of there. Yeah. So when the money comes back, you don't have it anymore.
You're not looking for their endorsement.
No. But it is the way I believe you advance the cause is with information and knowledge. Okay, for most people, it is a argument, it's a discussion that has no impact on them. Okay? Didn't on me when I was younger. And when you have kids, when your wife is pregnant, things get a little different. So you have to talk to the people who are in that position where they're actually grappling with that decision. Talking to a 15-year-old girl, okay, if she's not pregnant or not having sex, doesn't matter. Talking to a 40-year-old man who's already had his kids, whatever, they're focused on something else. So you pursue policies where you're talking to the people at their moment of crisis. And I think that's with information. And that is, A, do you really have a baby inside of you and why it's really a baby? And B, providing them an alternative. And there are plenty of alternatives. But here's the thing. For many young girls, It is a crisis of the moment. I'm in a corner, and I don't know what to do. And I think they're genuinely scared. I don't think they really want to, you know, that I want to kill my baby. It is, I see my life ending.
Yeah.
Because for a lot of young women, that's what's happening to them. Their mm-hmm. life has ended. I mean, forget the sort of social aspect of high school. You know, if they're looking at it from a longer-term point of view, college and career mm-hmm. and young mothers with children do not succeed in this world,
mm-hmm.
right? They can't get a job. I mean, the stats are mounted against them.
Mm-hmm.
There are alternatives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have got to pursue those. And we've got to make sure that they know about it. And to a certain extent, I think the state has a role to play in that. But the state, certainly through legislation, we can make sure they know about those alternatives. But it's interceding at that moment of crisis.
Sure.
Telling them before or trying to talk to people who aren't involved in the crisis, I'm not sure matters.
Yeah, I haven't boned up on, I should have checked what our current statute is on parental notification. Do you have an idea?
We notify, it's got the judicial bypass, so it's kind of weak.
Okay.
But we do have a parental notification. We don't have a parental consent.
Okay.
But we have parental notification in Iowa.
Okay. That's a lot of states are in that boat. Speaking about parents, you know, what's your stance on parental rights in education, you know, school choice, and what would you be willing to do as governor to champion the cause of parental choice in education in the state?
We have to have more choice. But let me say this first of all. I believe we have to do something which I call public charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I haven't given up on the public school system yet, okay? I'm fully supportive of parents who want to homeschool their kids. I mean, those folks are heroes I couldn't do that. But you have to respect those people who are willing to make that commitment to do it, because it's a huge commitment. So we have to be supportive of that. And the state has actually been hostile to homeschoolers for the last 3 years. We need to have more support for our private schools. The tuition textbook tax credit is taking a hit. And we have to make sure, and see, there are a lot of people in the Republican Party that are opposed to AEAs. The fact is, your private schools need those AEAs in place, and we better start recognizing that as Republicans, that if you support private education, you need to be supportive of the infrastructure that allows them to do what they need to do, to be able to do it when they want to avail themselves, especially if they've got special needs kids in those schools. And we want to make sure that kids with special needs can have that choice in education, that they aren't limited to only public school system.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to have more choice. And part of what goes along with more choice is more choice for parents who are part of the public school system. That maybe for whatever reason, particularly look around some communities, I mean, look, if you're a Methodist, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many Methodist private schools are there in the state?
I think
there's one.
Okay.
How many Lutheran private schools are in the state?
Quite a few elementary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in high school, not very many, right?
Maybe one or two.
To a certain extent, yeah. it's our Catholic brothers and sisters mm-hmm. that are bearing that burden. And if you are not of their faith persuasion, you don't really see that you have a lot of other options. Now, people may send their kids there. But what I'm trying to point out is there are a lot of parents
mm-hmm.
that are not happy with their school district, are concerned about the education their kids are getting. And while they hear about choice, they don't really think it's a choice for them. They don't see themselves as having that choice. So here's my tap on Terry Branstad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We had a moment in time where we tried to create public charter schools, called them frontier schools.
Okay.
Would have broken the back of the ISEA because it would have been outside of collective bargaining.
Gotcha.
Okay? Every school district in the state would have experimented with it, or at least the larger ones would have experimented with it. Vetoed it. No, I believe in a fit of anger at his fellow Republicans, whatever the case was. Maybe he thought he was going to bring us back to special session. That was his last act as governor. They could set school reform back, you know. Obviously, for 12 years,
mm-hmm.
More than a decade, it was a great moment. And we need to open that up. We need to get back to it. Part of my belief about public schools, and I'm veering off topic like I have on every other question.
That's okay.
We spend so much time on the kids who are perhaps most troubled, okay? Special mm-hmm. needs kids in many cases. But our best and our brightest, we're failing those kids more than the kids that are most academically challenged, because we've left these kids alone. That these bright kids, these talented and gifted kids, well, they're fine. And as a result, they never meet their potential. They get bored.
Mm-hmm.
They don't try. And as a result, they won't meet their potential. And they end up, in many cases, not being ready for college. Because they're bored. They've tuned out. I've known kids that are straight-A students in high school that get to college, and man, are they suddenly in trouble, because this is suddenly work.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't had to work at all. They've sloughed by. That's why I want to see things like magnet schools. Why I want to see charter schools. Because I think there's a role to play with those kinds of institutions for mm-hmm. our best and brightest.
Now, regarding school choice as well, tax vouchers or tax credits, something, you know, I home educate, my mm-hmm. wife and I do, and something we've always been frustrated with, and I know this is probably a selfish aspect of the question, but there's been nothing, I mean, we can't even take, you know, book cost of books off on our mm-hmm. taxes, where people who do private education can deduct some of their tuition, I believe.
Tuition and textbook tax credit, yep.
Yeah.
Hey, here's the thing. That ought to be available for all parents, whether you're home educating them mm-hmm. or whether I'm sending my kids to the public schools. Because we're in a situation today where a public education that's supposed to be a free education,
mm-hmm.
it's not free anymore. Okay, we're all getting hit with book fees.
Mm-hmm.
We're all asked to spend more money to support our kids going to school. It's not a free education anymore. And so we all ought to be able to do that, whether it be you with your kids at home, if you're sending your kids to Bishop Heelan, or whether mm-hmm. I'm sending my kids to East Middle. We all ought to have that same ability.
Okay. And last question.
And
go ahead.
Back to your point on vouchers. I have been hesitant to embrace vouchers in the past, mm-hmm. in part because I was afraid it would be the death knell of public schools.
Okay.
I'm no longer afraid that it's the death knell of public schools. And I think it's something we're going to have to explore. Okay. I think it's a tough sell mm-hmm. in this state. But for me to say I support public charter schools, but not to support a private charter school or a private school, the same sort of, it's inconsistent.
Yeah.
And I hate that. So I'm ready to do it. I think it's a tough sell.
Mm-hmm.
I
think competition's
but I'm ready. Yeah, I've always supported everything up to, mm-hmm. including a voucher. But I'm there now.
Okay.
It's. I think we have so many challenges with our school districts that we're going to have to do things in this state we've never been willing to do before.
Okay.
And it may be that the only way you can solve some of these problems is by doing something like that. And what it will be, and what I actually see happening, it's not that it is necessarily religious institutions that are creating these, you know, taking mm-hmm. advantage of that, but we'll see other entities come along. For-profit, not-for-profit,
sure.
perhaps not affiliated with a religious institution mm-hmm. to try to offer those educational opportunities. And we've got to do it, because what we're doing right now, it isn't working, and we mm-hmm. can't be afraid to challenge. And as long as the parents can make that decision, if they don't think their kids are getting the kind of education they need and they can pull back, fine, then they can do that. But right mm-hmm. now, they don't have any choice to do it. If they feel their kids aren't getting the education they need, well, complain to the teacher, complain to the principal, but they're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have stagnated as a state when it comes to our education, because we haven't been willing to change. We haven't kept up with what's going on in the rest of the country and the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to do that. We have rested on our laurels for too long. Thinking, we've got a good education system.
A lot of times they just teach to a test, and there's no innovation. There's no not developing critical thinking skills. A lot of it's just indoctrination, you know.
And we're getting by.
Exactly.
And we're just getting by. And
the
problem
is the box.
The rest of the country and the rest of the world have caught up, and they've passed us. And so we have to start thinking about it in terms of, we're not just talking about competing with Minnesota or Wisconsin. We're competing with India and China.
Mm-hmm.
Look, when I was trying to pick out presidential candidates, I asked every presidential candidate what they thought about India and China, because I'm convinced that's who our competition is, and that's who our kids are competing against for jobs. We don't think about it that way, but that's the reality. When they get out of school and they go into the real world, we're all competing against those people. The world is flat.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things I don't like about Tom Friedman. But what he talks about the World Economics is true.
Mm-hmm.
The world is flat. And
it is.
That's part of the challenge that we're facing in Iowa today from our manufacturing sector, our education sector, you name it. It's what's going on. Again, I veered off topic.
Oh, no,
sorry.
No, actually, that was good. Last question I have is, you know, I work with juvenile offenders.
Mm-hmm.
It's been my passion for the last 7 years in a ministry called Serve Our Youth Network. And I'm concerned about, it's not your typical Republican question, I'm concerned about recidivism. And as kids reenter the community, many end up later on becoming adult offenders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Iowa's prisoner population is growing.
That's why
we're talking about building prisons.
Well, that's why if these drug courts get cut because of this across-the-board cut,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a dumb cut. That's
mm-hmm.
an example. That's a dumb cut because we know that sort of peer group follow-up kind of a situation pays dividends. At least it does with my experience, what I've seen that's gone on in the Woodbury County drug court. Those are the kinds of things that work. And try to intercede with those young people and keep them on the straight, knowing that somebody's looking after them and they're going to be held accountable for their actions and there's mm-hmm. going to be follow-up for it. And you try to divert them out of the straight prison system. And I don't know how we keep that going right now. I mean, I don't. It's going to be a challenge. But that's the kind of thing that we ought to be exploring.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure, it does.
Or were you talking about something else?
No,
I think for so many of these kids, it's related to drugs. You tell me if I'm wrong.
No, well, actually, at Polk County Youth Services, about 70% of the kids are drug involved when they go in. So that is a huge issue in their life. Reentry issues when they come out. You know, the kids are typically looking at, what am I going to do for a job? How am I going to finish my high school education? You know, how am I going to kick this drug habit?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how family life really sucks right now. What am I going to do about this? And they're plopped in the same environment they came out of before they were arrested. The organization I'm with is just starting a new program to focus on reentry aftercare issues. So I think part of what the state needs to look at is those private public partnerships, which unfortunately was killed at Newton with IFI. Now, if you were elected governor, would you invite them back in?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We're worried about the faith-based initiative. I missed the acronym, but that's what we're talking about, right?
Well, or even community-based, yeah. I mean, just, yeah, the whole thinking outside the box as far as, you know, what can we do restoratively, what can we do in partnership with other agencies, just because, you know, state obviously can only have a piece of that reentry puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was very disappointed to see, even though IFI was willing to continue on without the state funding.
They wanted to shove them out.
Culver just booted them out, yeah.
Which, I don't understand why. I mean, and I remember the debate when we were first bringing them in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some things defy logic.
Okay, so you would invite them in, you'd look at different options, and that's probably not necessarily your area of expertise.
No, it is not my area of expertise, but here's what I do know. Especially as we're leading up to a time where the state has very limited resources,
mm-hmm.
you need to partner with folks. You look at what's driving part of our state budget problem, okay? I mean, the amount of money we're spending locking folks up, growing part of our state budget, and it's a part of the state budget you can't cut very easily.
Yeah.
Okay, now we can look at privatizing and some things like that. And I've yet to be convinced that we need to be building those new prisons down in Fort Madison, but that's an infrastructure question. But if you want to deal with people that are locked up, and the fact is we're not going to, I mean, this wave of young people
mm-hmm.
that are being locked up, and what happens to them years from now,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a huge, the escalating cost. We don't talk about this, but to house a prisoner today, and as they get older, that cost goes up.
Well, and also another aspect to the organization I work with is we mentor children of prisoners, and the Bureau of Prisons have said that 70% of kids who has an incarcerated parents end up being
incarcerated
up.
Too.
Exactly. So I mean, we've got a huge problem coming down the pipe if we don't address it. Well, any last thoughts? Just anything you'd like to add before we conclude?
No, I don't know. I've kind of rambled along here. And this is what you see with me is what you get. Okay. I talk a lot. I got a lot of stuff in my mind I want to get out. And I'm not very good at talking in sound bites. But I would say beware the politician that is.
Okay.
Because there are no silver bullets. And that's what people need to understand. Too many of these problems are interrelated.
Mm-hmm.
And there are not simple solutions. And you, if you're a voter, you need to be looking for the person who's looking at how you solve some of these problems and getting into the nitty-gritty. So